I like to choose a theme verse for these presentations. And the verse I chose tonight, I thought, you know, this is such an obvious missions verse. I'm not sure I should go with it, but it fits John Mason Peck really well. And also, I heard the voice of the Lord saying, "Whom shall I send, and who will go for us?" Then said I, "Here am I, send me." And thank you, ladies, for singing about that theme just a moment ago. It is a privilege for me to teach on John Mason Peck. I have known about Peck for a long time. I study American church history, and I've taught it for years. But if you had asked me 6 months ago to do a presentation on John Mason Peck, it would have lasted approximately 90 seconds. And I really didn't know that much about this man, other than everybody talked about his influence. And so it is a joy for me to teach about him for the first time with you here tonight. And I'm going to let his story speak for itself. So without further ado, let us dive into the story of that man, John Mason Peck. I'm afraid that's the only picture we have of him. I'm going to divide this into two parts. Part one tonight is Saved and Sent, 1789 to 1826. First section, to age 24. He was a farmer, grew up in Connecticut. Litchfield, Connecticut is where he was born. There you can see Litchfield in the upper left-hand part. He was a rarity of the time. He was an only child. That didn't happen a whole lot in the late 18th century. His parents were Congregationalists, so like most good Congregationalists, they had their baby sprinkled as an infant. Because his dad was lame, he was an invalid, we don't know exactly how he came to be that way, but from a very young age, John was put to work on the farm. He learned a strong work ethic, and really the family depended on him to run the show. He was given a grammar school education. That's all he really ever got, and ironically, he struggled with his grammar. What he's going to accomplish later is going to be an astonishing development and is going to be a tribute to the fact that he was self-taught in almost everything he's going to do. As a teenager, he's a farmer, he's working hard, and revival comes to his community. About 3 miles away, there was a preacher who was part of the Second Great Awakening. The Second Great Awakening was this tremendous revival that started in the late 1780s in America, picked up steam in the 1790s, and really peaked between 1800 and 1820. And during those years, schools and churches all up and down the eastern seaboard, over to the Alleghenies, were experiencing tremendous revival. It really transformed America. The Second Great Awakening is a story that is not told often enough because America had sunk into considerable irreligion by the 1770s. And the Second Great Awakening really rescued American culture. And he heard a preacher, and he wrestled with the preaching for about a week, went every night to hear this man. And then at the age of 18, in 1807, December 15th, 1807, he got saved. I like his testimony. He said, "The total depravity of the human heart," you'll like this, Pastor Warren. Pastor Warren wants me to call him TD for total depravity. "The total depravity of the human heart was a doctrine I was early acquainted with. I felt a pleasure, therefore, in ascribing the whole work of salvation to the Lord, being sensible of my own weakness and my absolute dependence on divine grace." Almost immediately, as a teenager, he began to wonder if God would have him be a preacher. He was asking that question, "Lord, can I go?" But it was going to be a hard thing for him to be a preacher. For one thing, he was needed on the farm. That is, it was kind of hard to say to his invalided dad and his mom, "Hey, I'm going to take off and go somewhere and be a preacher for a living." Furthermore, in the New England establishment of the day, it was expected that you would have a good knowledge of Greek, a working knowledge of Latin so you could read theological textbooks, a general education so that you could communicate intelligently. That is, a clergyman were supposed to be leaders in their communities, and he doesn't have it. The third obstacle is that he married Sarah on May 8th, 1809. Now, that don't misunderstand that. Once he's a married man now, he's got responsibilities to care for her. She was a godly woman, as we're going to see throughout the story. She's willing to follow him wherever he's going to go. But in his mind, it's just more entanglement. Is there any way he can break free of this? About 13 months after they marry, Eli Prince is born, their first son. And I put a slash there so we can keep track of the number of children they're going to have. That is, there are going to be several. But he's in the Word, and he's reading the Word, and he's studying it, and he's developing this passion to share what he's learning with others. If he was nothing else, John Mason Peck is going to be a dynamo of passion to be involved in the Lord's work. And as he's reading the Word, he begins questioning his infant baptism. He's going to show a significant independent streak all his life. In fact, if he had faults, and everybody has faults, basically everybody that meets him is going to say, you know, you sure are opinionated. Now, he was a generous person with others, and he was gentle with others, but he knew his own mind and really thought everybody should agree with him. And he decided to have conversations with a Congregationalist pastor that he respected a great deal, Lyman Beecher, who is really going to become an institution in America. His son, Henry Ward, is going to be one of the famous preachers in America, although not a particularly reputable person. One of his daughters is going to be Harriet Beecher Stowe, and a very famous American family. And Lyman Beecher sets out to convince John Mason Peck that infant baptism is biblical. And by the time they had met several times, Peck was absolutely convinced that it wasn't biblical. You know, it's almost like, if that's the best argument you got, then I'm pretty sure I shouldn't be a Congregationalist. He finally broke free of mom and dad. They had to get hired help thereafter. His mom understood. She was a godly woman and gave him her blessing. Dad did not understand. And it was a very difficult parting, but he and his wife moved to Greene County, Windham, New York. I've shown it to you there on the map. And he joined a community of farmers and said, "Are there any Baptists around here?" And he found some. He found a church close to the farm where he was living in Windham, New Durham Baptist Church, and he sought baptism from them. And on September 13th, 1811, he was baptized into the church. He said at the day he was baptized, he had been in the church for several months, and he had been learning Baptist theology and spending time with the family there, the church family. And he said, the day I was baptized, people came up to me and said, "Are you going to be a preacher? We really think you should probably be a preacher." And so they began giving him opportunities to what he called improve his gift. Opportunities to share his testimony, to share devotionals, and then eventually to preach his first sermon. His first sermon was texted out of Mark 16:15. He preached on the Great Commission: go into all the world and preach. Well, I just gave you the Matthew version, but he preached on the Great Commission. He started preaching in surrounding communities, including the community of Catskill. Catskill was on a neighboring mountain, and Catskill was a little group of Baptists that didn't have a pastor. And they said, "Would you come be our pastor? We'll actually have a salary, but we'll give you whatever comes in the offering plate every week." And so he went, and what came in the offering every week was about a dollar. So he kept farming, and he got his dollar a week, and he started learning how to pastor. And the Lord gave them a daughter, Hannah, born July 10th, their second child. And by June 9th of the following year, the pastors in the area came together and they investigated his theology, discovered he was very sound, and ordained him to the gospel ministry. So he's now a preacher, but his heart is not in the mountains of New York. That is, from the moment he got saved, he was one of these guys that was constantly looking at the horizon. Where can I go to be effective in the Lord's work? And it wasn't that he was making a dollar a week, it's that he just felt like there were other fields. He was constantly looking to the fields where he could serve. And he went through some really hard times. I mentioned yesterday that some great men of God have battled depression. Peck went through some dark days. He felt inadequate, he didn't have much education. And, you know, one of the things that feeds depression is being overworked, underpaid, and lots of kids. It all kind of came together. And his biographer, and basically this entire story, is based on a biography that was written just a couple of years after his death by a man named Babcock, and it is our source of information on Peck. And I read several other things, and I discovered that everything they were saying, I already knew from having read the biography by Babcock. That is kind of the source. And Babcock says that this experience better prepared him to minister successfully to the spiritual maladies or the morbid imaginations of others. That is, there were no counseling programs back then, and you didn't get a degree in biblical counseling, but if you do pastoral work in any generation, you will find yourself talking to struggling people. And Peck is going to spend a lot of his time in later years helping people through their struggles, and part of the reason he could was because he went through a lot of struggles. Well, it's 1813, and if he continued on there as a pastor in the mountains of New York, no doubt the Lord could have richly blessed him and rewarded him in heaven, but I probably wouldn't be telling you his story. The fact is, that horizon is beckoning, and he is going to head west now over the next 4 years. One of the inspirations in his life was the story of William Carey. And he began reading about Carey, and he said, I sure wish I could go somewhere like Carey went to India and be used. But then he immediately writes in his diary, but alas, how idle and vain are my thoughts. In this place I am too faithless, too prone to wander. Oh, that I might first learn to perform the duties which come within my reach, and not presume to think I should be more faithful in another part of the vineyard. All right, well, I'm going to resist the temptation to preach little mini-sermons every 8 slides because I've got a lot of story I want to tell you tonight. But that's convicting, isn't it? Because almost all of us can get to points in our life where we think if only our circumstances were a little different, we'd suddenly be super faithful. And God calls us to be faithful where we are. And he was. He began to be noticed by the other pastors in the region. He began to be given a number of openings to preach in addition to Catskill, so that he was preaching for $1 a week, but he was also going out and preaching several nights a week in addition to running his farm. And he got super sick. And this is going to be a pattern in his life. He's going to work himself to death, get ill, be bedridden for a while, get better, determined to slow down, and then speed up, get ill, be bedridden. All right, that's a cycle. And this is episode one. He resigned Catskill and moved to Amenia, New York on February 19, 1814, a slightly better established church, a church that he hoped would be a better sphere of influence for him. And then they had their third child, a son named Hervey. Hervey actually was one of the preachers that was helping to mentor him. He named his son after him. He discovered that the church in Amenia was kind of cold. It had a lot of sin in it. And although they promised him a salary, they didn't pay it very faithfully. And his eyes are still on the horizon, and he's still working like a dog every week, supporting his family, preaching all he can. And he found a fellow preacher who knew Greek, and he begins studying Greek with his fellow believer. And Greek is hard to learn. All right, it's very different from English. Now, if you learn Greek, it'll make your English better. But he's trying to learn Greek, and he's wrestling with it, and he's making progress. And then shortly thereafter, another dynamo came to town, a man by the name of Luther Rice. I mentioned Luther Rice in connection with Adoniram Judson. Rice was the guy who went to India, decided that he had become a Baptist too, sailed back to America to raise money for the Judsons. Well, he's only been in America for about a year at this point. Well, a little over a year. And he travels into the mountains of New York to Amenia and meets this young Pastor Peck. And Rice saw something in Peck. He said, you know what? I'm getting a missions agency started in Western New York. Would you be willing in your spare time to be the agent for this missions agency? And Peck said, well, what will that involve? And he said, well, it'll involve traveling all over the place, raising money for missions. You'll sort of like be my arm in Western New York. And Peck said, love it. Send me out. And we're told that he rode 440 miles, preached 19 times, and took 5 missionary collections over the next few weeks. That is, he's just, Peck only has one speed, and it made me tired to read about him. He is terribly burdened for missions, and Rice is trying to get him to become a missionary. Rice is recruiting him. 3 little children right now, a wife who kind of wants to be a farmer's wife. And Rice is saying there is opportunity either overseas or overland, go west, either way, there is opportunity. And there was a strong pull. He desperately wanted to go. And God provided a push. Whenever you are changing in the Christian life, God redirects us via pull and push. He works in our desires, and then he gives us reasons to go. And the push in this case was that the Armenia church was totally failing to pay his salary. He had to open a school to teach, to supplement his income. He had actually done that previously, and I didn't mention it. He would open these schools, night schools, like William Carey had done, previous generation. And his health began to fail again because he was overworking. So at the end of 1815, he resigned his church and said, I'm going to do it. I'm going to go to the field. Lord, you're going to have to make this happen. That is, he didn't have a way to make money. He just resigned his church and said, Lord, send me, and you'll have to pay for it. Rice had told him that Western mission was for him, and Rice had pull among the regional Baptists. In particular, Rice knew the pastor of the leading church in Philadelphia, a man by the name of William Stoughton. Stoughton, interestingly, had been present in Kettering in 1792 when the Baptist Missionary Society that sent out William Carey was founded. Stoughton was an American who was visiting England as a teenager and was in the room when they voted this organization together. He went back to America with a burden for missions. And he's going to be a driving force from his very significant pastorate, Sansom Street Baptist Church in Philadelphia. So Stoughton said, I will train you to do this. You come to Philadelphia and live with me for about 6 months, and I will prepare you for missions. So you got a busy city pastor who's willing to train a young man who's a farmer for missionary work. And while he was there, Stoughton taught him Hebrew, he taught him Latin, he taught him general studies, and put him to work. Right? And Peck worked like a maniac in Sansom Street Baptist Church for months, just pouring himself into the labors there. And the church loved him. But Sarah, they couldn't put her up. It wasn't possible for Sarah and three little children to go to Philadelphia. So they stayed in New York the whole time Peck was receiving this training. I'll just keep going. We'll say more about that. Peck also was preparing with a definite goal in mind. The Triennial Convention had started in 1814. Luther Rice had been proclaiming that they needed this. The 48 associations, roughly, all came together. They elected a president, a Southerner, by the name of Richard Furman, and they established a national organization that would meet every 3 years with the goal of sending out missionaries. The first missionaries they supported were Adoniram and Ann Judson, and the Judsons were sure happy to get that first check because they'd gone like 2 years without support. And then they started looking for other missionaries to support. At their second meeting, 1817, Peck applied. Rice had sort of prepared the way. He had been telling people who were leaders in the convention, we need a Western mission. We need to get somebody out into the Missouri Territory preaching the gospel. If we don't, the Methodists are going to sweep the West. All right, the Methodists are very active, and they've got all these circuits that they're writing. And while the Methodists are preaching the gospel, praise the Lord, they're baptizing babies, and they're all Arminians. We need to get out there and beat the Methodists. And so Rice kind of sold the convention on this, and Peck applied. Another man had studied along with him there. His name was James Welch. And after extensive discussions, they decided to endorse the mission and support Peck and Welch as missionaries to St. Louis and the surrounding areas, to be determined by the missionaries when they got out there. And Peck wrote in his diary, it is a solemn consideration. I have now put my hand to the plow. O Lord, may I never turn back, never regret this step. It is my desire to live, to labor, to die as a kind of pioneer in advancing the gospel. That's his goal. So at the age of 28, John and Sarah Peck, and by the way, sometimes she's called Sally Peck. She was called Sally by family members, and Peck later said, you know, she liked to be called Sally by people who knew her really closely, but she was a little embarrassed by it. In churches, she would always say, I'm Sarah. You know, it was like her formal name. So we'll go with Sarah. Wouldn't want to embarrass her. So early labors, ages 28 to 30. You say, this is a really small segment. That's because what he's about to do in the next 2 years is going to blow your socks off. It's unbelievable how this cyclone blows into St. Louis. So here we go. They leave on July 25th, 1817. It was a 1,200-mile journey. They took off in a one-horse wagon. They were able to catch a riverboat for part of the way, but it was a long, grueling journey. He arrived in St. Louis on December 1st. His health had really declined during the trip. The first 2 months he was there, he was simply recovering. The Welch family arrived actually slightly before them, and they started their efforts. So what do? You're in this brand new area. There are almost no there were no evangelical churches in St. Louis when they arrived. It was basically a cow town, a jumping off point for the West. Well, they started a school. That school started attracting the children of settlers immediately. Pretty soon they had more kids than they knew what to do with. They started a church, First Baptist Church, the first evangelical church in St. Louis. They started a Sunday school for whites in association with the church, but then they also started a Sunday school for African Americans, most of whom were slaves. This was Missouri, and slavery was established there, and Peck hated it. And he launched immediately into trying to improve the condition of these African Americans that were all around him. He is going to spend a significant amount of time investing in that community during his life. Starts out with 14 students, and in less than a year, over 100 of these black children are receiving training. They baptized their first converts in the Mississippi River before the year was out, and they began to lay plans for what they thought would be their most significant work, a seminary for training the pastors in the West. Let me just break from my slide for a moment. Baptists have been coming into the West for 20 years. Mostly farmers who would move West and say, hey, we don't have any pastor here. I'll be the pastor. In Baptist history, we call them farmer preachers. They had little or no training. They had very little theological background. But they had been a good layman in a church in North Carolina or Tennessee or somewhere. And they just move out to the Mississippi and say, well, no pastor, I'll be the pastor. And there are these guys all over the frontier. And when Peck arrives, he discovers that there are a lot of these little Baptist churches, but their pastors are profoundly ignorant. That is, they really don't know much about theology, the ministry. And he says, if we could start a school to train these men, it could change the West. That's on his heart. It's going to take a while, but that's the burden. But he's not going to settle in St. Louis. Welch kind of settles in St. Louis. Peck begins itinerating ministries across eastern Missouri and up in, and over into southern Illinois. And here's what he said about his initial impressions. At the period of our visit, there were three parties of Baptists in Illinois that had about the same fraternal intercourse with each other as the Jews and Samaritans of the old time. And I just say the more things change, right? Furthermore, these itinerating ministries are not on paved roads between established cities. This is dangerous travel. Indian-infested areas, barren areas, subject to the weather, the climate. And I just give you a little sample of Peck's sense of humor and outlook on life. If you have a piece of jerk venison and a bit of pone with a cup of water, you may make out a splendid supper, provided you think so, for as a man thinketh, so is he. All right, so there's good application of biblical principle. In other words, you know, I didn't eat that well, but hey, I'm young. During these travels, one of the highlights of his first year in the West was meeting Daniel Boone. Daniel Boone by this time was in his 80s. He was a legend in America. He came from a family of Kentucky Baptists, and Peck was able to sit and chat with him for a while, and then he held a service. And Boone brought his whole family to the service and heard Peck preach. And Peck wrote in his diary, "I don't believe I've ever met a more gentle and humble and considerate man than Daniel Boone," which was a side of Daniel Boone that you don't get from the Disney shows. All right. So that was a blessing. Maybe we'll all get to meet Daniel Boone someday. Early in 1818, their fourth child was born. They named him William Carey Peck. Peck believed that in order to accomplish lasting results, you can't just be a lone ranger. You can't just ride around, do a little work, and just leave it unorganized. So he was an organizer to the extreme. And he and Welch and several of the other pastors in the region who were willing to consider it began what they called the United Society for the Spread of the Gospel. And that United Society started various funds, an education fund, an Indian fund, and a mission fund. And so as they traveled around, they would take up offerings, and they would distribute these funds, and they would use the funds to buy books, to provide free education for Indians, and to support further missions across the Mississippi. He was always fundraising, organizing, supporting mission. He also affiliated with the Missouri, he also organized the Missouri Bible Society. The American Bible Society had started about 1816. Its goal was to publish Bibles to be distributed across America. So he starts an arm of that society in Missouri. He's going to be affiliated with that for the rest of his life. He starts mite societies everywhere he goes. This is from the widow's mites. These people are very poor. They may throw pennies in. But if he asks often enough, comes often enough, and collects enough pennies, you can get a lot done. And so little mite societies started all over the Midwest. And Peck would travel and meet with them and preach the gospel to them and collect the offerings. He had all of those organizations. Everything that I've described was started within 15 months of his arriving in St. Louis. That is, he just jumped into the work with both feet. Furthermore, a lot of the people there did not want to see him. That is, opposition was stirred up almost immediately. Three reasons. Number one, a lot of these farmer preachers have been taught a little bit of Calvinism. Most Baptists in America at this time were Calvinistic to varying degrees. That is, there were small free will Baptist presence, but it was very small. And so these farmer preachers in Carolina, Tennessee, Virginia, they were taught a little Calvinism. They went out to the frontier, and it just went to their heads. And hyper-Calvinism spread across the frontier in a horrible way. In particular, they said, anything you do, which is a human means to get the gospel to people, is denigrating the sovereignty of God. You've got to get out of the way and let God do it. And Peck would say, if you get out of the way, you're not obeying what God says to do. So hyper-Calvinism was a scourge. Secondly, there was just terrible ignorance. This man had a grammar school education, but he had taught himself Greek and Hebrew and Latin. And when he arrived on the frontier and wants to set up a school, a lot of these pastors are threatened by him. Oh, this highfalutin Easterner is coming and going to tell us what to do. And then third, there was just turf wars. They didn't want this missionary coming into their areas. Let me give you a few quotes to give you a taste of what Peck went through for the next 30 years. In 1817, he wrote the following. A set of crude and erroneous notions had been stereotyped in their minds in Kentucky about gospel doctrine and moral obligation. And they were fixedly resolved to learn nothing else. For several successive years, we met those brethren at associations when they took a bolder and more decided stand against all organized efforts to publish the glad tidings to a sin-ruined world. They maintained that missions, Sunday schools, Bible societies, and such like facilities were all men's contrivances to take God's work out of his own hands. Their views of the plan of salvation through Christ were exceeding limited and imperfect. And their success was quite as limited as their biblical knowledge was deficient. That is, they're opposing what we're doing, and they're not accomplishing anything themselves. A year later, 1818, he wrote, in many minds, crude antinomian notions were intermingled with scattered and detached fragments of gospel truth. They had no clear and correct notions of the connections of divine purposes and means to accomplish them. Because God worked in us to will and to do his own pleasure, they had no conception of human duty and responsibility. There was a mulish obstinacy about some of these men, as there is about the same class now. He wrote this 30 years later. They would not examine the... He wrote this about a year after, actually. So the now here is only a few months after he's talking about them. They would not examine the subject candidly and prayerfully. They shut their own eyes against the light, and as far as in their power, kept the members of their churches in darkness. They made the singular blunder in denying the use of all means and instrumentalities in the conversion of sinners and sending the gospel to the destitute, listen, while they were active and zealous in using means and trying to be instrumental as in opposing gospel measures. Let's just stop there. They won't use means to win people to Christ, but they sure use them to stop us. I mean, surely the sovereign God could stop us if he wanted to. A third cause of this anti-mission spirit and practice among a class of preachers originated in sheer selfishness. They knew their own deficiencies when contrasted with others, but instead of rejoicing that the Lord had provided better gifts to promote his cause, they felt the irritability of wounded pride, common to narrow and weak minds. Two more quotes. In 1820, he wrote, this is 1819, some of the preachers that were traveling around needed help. He said, a good English dictionary and a careful examination of the meaning of words with a smattering of the elements of rhetoric about tropes and figures and a slight touch of logic and mental philosophy would have been of great service to this class of preachers. But some of them were as much afraid of a dictionary as they were of a missionary. In 1825, I'm jumping ahead in my story a little bit, but one more. Thus was the singular spectacle presented of a party separating themselves from their brethren, denouncing and excluding them on the pretense of greater piety and more exact conformity to New Testament order, whose chief peculiarity consisted in their opposition to the Savior's command, go ye into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature, evangelize all nations. It is vain to pretend that these ministers and churches were only opposing some to them objectionable methods of complying with the Savior's commission, for they did not prosecute any other method. I call these Pex Judaizers. That is, the same way the Judaizers are going to hound Paul all the way through his ministry with a false gospel, these anti-mission, hard-shell, primitive Baptists opposed Peck all his life. Their key leader was Daniel Parker. Daniel Parker was somebody who could actually think, but he was so dogmatic about wrong ideas that he would think in deep, wrong ruts and be immovable once he established these positions. And he is going to face Peck in Illinois and over into Indiana over and over and over again. Parker is actually going to be elected a congressman in his state, and he's going to do everything in his power to block Peck's efforts. Parker attacked any ministry that you couldn't find chapter and verse in the New Testament, like Sunday schools, Bible societies, mission boards. The story of Peck centers around four locations, and at this point, let me just show them to you. St. Louis is right there near the Mississippi. He's going to move to St. Charles, which is actually about 20 miles northwest, right over the Missouri. He's later going to live in Rock Spring for most of his life. That's just across the Mississippi, if you can't tell from my picture in southern Illinois. And the seminary he's going to begin is going to be about 25 miles north of St. Louis in Alton. So sorry, my map's a little big, but that's a picture of Illinois Territory, Missouri Territory at the time. Next section. 1819 to 1822, trials in St. Charles. He moved to St. Charles in March of 1819 for a new headquarter. His goal was to establish a mission station and a seminary there. The Welches stayed in St. Louis so they could divide their efforts. I'm not going to say this over and over and over again, but Peck never stopped itinerating. That is, whenever he's not doing something else specifically, he's on the road going around to the churches. He just always was doing that, no matter where his headquarters was. He started a school. St. Charles Academy had 30 students within a month. It helped supplement his income. And he really believed that if you could up the literacy of the region, which is something probably they're going to try to do in PNG, get people reading and then give them a Bible and they'll read it, and your job is much easier. They started the first Sunday school ever in St. Charles. They held evening services for the colored people. saw steady conversions and became beloved in that community. And he continued his itinerant ministries, doing all the things that we've already discussed. But things were hard. They had another daughter, Mary Ann, born on September 18th, second daughter, their fifth child. And 2 weeks after her birth, their first child, Eli, passed away at the age of 10, caught a fever, and died. Almost exactly a year later in the fall, they lost little William Carey, who was just 3. Now, these deaths are for very different reasons than the death of the Judson's children. It's not because of these tropical diseases. It's just that frontier life was really hard. It was a tough life. And then in 1820, one of the great trials of his life came. He's lost these children that year, and the Board of Missions of the Triennial Convention decides that we will support foreign missionaries like the Judsons and others that are going overseas, but we're not a home mission board. We want to just limit ourselves to foreign missions. And they contacted Peck and said, "We're shutting down your mission." Eli had just died. This was a very bleak time. "Peck, we want you to join Isaac McCoy, who's doing Indian missionary work. We're willing to continue supporting that because that's not home missions. It's a different people group. But we don't want missions just to settlers anymore. Welch, you stay in St. Louis and pastor, but we're going to stop sending you checks." Now, we 21st century people say, why in the world would they obey this board when they're not promising them any financial support? And the fact is, they didn't view themselves as having any authority outside the churches. And the churches were telling them to do this, and they said, well, okay. And Welch obeyed and pastored there in St. Louis for a while. Peck, though, wrote a strongly worded letter back to Philadelphia in which he said, "I think this is a terrible decision. Number one, my wife is in such health that I cannot transport her all the way to Fort Wayne. I have a one-month-old baby daughter, not to mention the son who just died. And furthermore, St. Louis still needs us. That is, there is a great work going on here. The argument of the Easterners was, there are so many settlers going out there that we don't need missionaries in the West anymore." Well, that was a misapprehension. And finally, they wrote him and said, "Okay, you can stay in Missouri, but we're not going to send you any checks, so good luck to you." And they went through 2 years that were very lean. Peck drew on his farmer background. He cared for his family by growing crops. He ran a school to supplement that. He continued to pastor there in St. Charles and to itinerate. That is, he was doing all the stuff he used to do, but now he's supporting his family by farming in addition. And he started looking for somebody else that would support him, and he found him in Massachusetts, an alternative missionary support agency. He wrote to Dr. Baldwin there and said, "Do you think you guys could take us on?" And the Massachusetts Baptist Missionary Society took them on in March of 1822 for $5 a week. All right, so now maybe we can survive. Expanding ministry. This will be about the end of our story. In April of 1822, they moved to Rock Spring, Illinois. There are no motives given in the biography for why they keep moving around. Other than that, it seemed like a better place. So Rock Spring seemed like a better place. Rock Spring is no longer there. It was swallowed up by O'Fallon later on. They planted a church in May. Very short time. He was pastoring a thriving church. Rock Spring is going to be their home base for the rest of his life in ministry. Sarah is basically going to be at Rock Spring for the rest of our story. In order to integrate himself into the community, in addition to all his other duties, he became the community postmaster. He's going to serve as postmaster from July 12, 1827 until 1850. But guess how often he's going to be there to collect the mail? Sarah is going to be the unofficial postmaster of Rock Spring for the next 23 years, something that she did not bargain on with all the children they have, mentioning among whom were William Stoughton, born November 13th, their fourth son and their sixth child. Peck had gone out on a missionary journey. He had traveled over into southern Illinois and was preaching. And his wife had her hardest labor of the 10 labors she's going to have. In fact, they thought they were going to lose her. She pulled through, And the baby survived, and Peck got home in January to find out that his wife had barely survived and that he met his new son. This was not terribly unusual. Nothing stopped Peck except his own health. And at times, it's hard to defend. In fact, he wrote a letter to the Massachusetts Society in 1822, December 31st, giving a report. He did these every year. This is the only one I'm going to quote to you. In fact, earlier today, I deleted about four others. With sincerity of soul, I can say there is no pursuit that affords such exquisite satisfaction as activity and success in measures to promote the gospel. I might dwell upon the difficulties attendant on an itinerating life, as absence from home, exposure to sickness, storms, cold, mud, swimming rivers, and not unfrequently rough fare. But these are trifles not worthy of one moment's anxious concern. Did you appreciate the fact that the only negative we heard about P&G was the fact that it's hard to get there? I mean, I'm sure there are going to be other negatives. But these are trifles not worth a moment's anxious concern if you are living and laboring for him who died for the redemption of man. That is the highest favor which we need seek after in this transitory life. In 1825, he became an agent for the American Bible Society. Directly, the national organization. That gave him clout. And he started traveling around providing Bibles in all these communities. And he kind of laughingly said in his journal, "Even the anti-missions people can't complain about me giving out Bibles. You know, I think I'm safe now." In 1824, shortly thereafter, the American Sunday School Union was begun. As soon as he heard word of it, he wrote them a letter and said, "I'm starting Sunday schools all over this region. Can I be one of your agents?" And they appointed him their Western agent. That year also, Illinois had a battle over slavery. There was a majority of legislators in Illinois that wanted to make Illinois a slave state. The governor was strongly opposed to it. A good nucleus of legislators were opposed to it. But maybe the guy who led the fight was John Mason Peck. Peck went to the headquarters, which was in Vandalia, Illinois then, and gave impassioned pleas against slavery. He rallied people in the communities to oppose it. Southern Illinois was, as a block, opposed to it, interestingly. And it was defeated. Voted down August 2nd, 1824. Imagine the difference in our nation's history, not to mention Illinois' history, if that had gone the other way. This was a huge deal. He also... Oh, by the way, I've got to give another brief quote. Here is Peck in 1824 talking about slavery. "Point to me the man who will not lift his voice against the trade of human souls and blood, and I pronounce that he neither loves his country nor his God." So abhorrent from the sentiments of our nature is the practice of stealing humans, selling and enslaving immortal souls, that it is difficult to describe and define this wretched degradation of man. Now, the Southern Baptist Convention is going to happen during his lifetime. There were a whole lot of people who lived 20 miles from him who would have been somewhat offended by this sentiment. But he believed it. You say, when did this guy ever study? On his horse. He read scripture as he was traveling between engagements, and he carried a pencil with him. And every time he came to a passage he didn't quite understand, he'd circle it. And then when he got home, he would study it out using Matthew Henry and the other commentaries. And then he also became a student of revival. He attended the camp meetings of the Methodists, the Cumberland Presbyterians, and others. I can't go into it in detail, but these camp meetings became known for their wild behavior. People running in the aisles and fainting and crying out. And Peck did not form a high opinion of all this. In fact, his critique of it was, "All this excitement and effect, so far as visible, might have been produced without the agency of God, and might be and seem to be only the effect of human causes. And frankly, these people are running around screaming. Later on, oftentimes they prove false, worse than worthless." Worse than worthless because? Well, now they've had this incredible experience. How do you preach the gospel to them? So he was opposed to all that nonsense. By 1824, Parker had galvanized the Illinois churches against him. Six of the eight or nine associations were anti-missionary. You say, well, he's losing. Well, not out in the communities. 43 Bible societies and over 100 Sunday schools, many of them developed later into churches, were established by 1825 through Peck's efforts. And in 1825, he took his first big journey. I just have four more slides. He headed east. It was a 4,400-mile round trip. He wanted to notify the eastern churches of what was going on in the west. He knew he could not succeed without eastern support. And so he went to the preliminary meetings of the Triennial Convention, and he observed convention politics. He met someone who's going to be very important in his life, Jonathan Going. And by the way, if you support missions, Going is a great name. And he visited his parents. His dad actually had passed away. His mom was living alone there on the farm, and he committed to bring mom home with him. She's going to return to Rock Spring and live with them for the rest of her life. And he made a proposal to the Massachusetts Baptist Mission Society for Western evangelism. The proposal had three aspects. He said, would you support me in an itinerant system of circuit preaching? The Methodists do it really well because bishops appoint them. We're Baptists. We don't do this real well, but I'd like to. You support me, and I will systematically visit every church in Missouri and Illinois. And sometimes I'll go into Kentucky and Indiana just for kicks. Secondly, St. Louis needs to be the hub of this operation. And third, we need a theological school. And in order to start a theological school, he needs to know something about theological schools. So he spent about a month visiting Columbian, Brown, Hamilton, and Newton, studying their methods of instruction and getting advice on how to organize a theological school. While he was away, their seventh child was born, John Quincy Adams. But he was corresponding with his wife, we know that, because he met John Quincy Adams during his trip and wrote home and said, I think we should name our son after this president. I really like him. I'm not telling you a fraction of what he did, but I've got to share a couple of these things that are amazing. Easterners said, what's the West like? Some of them said, we're going to move out there, but we want to know what it's like before we get there. And he wrote a book, Guide for Emigrants. He described life in the West, and over the next 20 years of revising this book, he's going to become the quintessential expert on Western life and customs. That is, if anybody want to know what life in the West is like, read Mr. Peck. Well, they want to get a seminary going. He returns home and tells his wife, they're for it. They want us to start a seminary. But you know what this means, right, Sarah? I'm going to have to travel east and raise the money for it. So in February 1826, he took off on another trip east. These trips would normally take about 10 months. Over those 10 months, he raised four-fifths of the money, and he met Dr. Shurtleff. And Dr. Shurtleff of Boston said, I'll donate $10,000 towards your institution. And even the biographer writing in the 1860s said, you know, that's not a lot of money. But nobody else was given $10,000. And so later it's going to be Shurtleff College. Tomorrow night, we'll pick up the story in 1827. And if it seems like he's doing a lot right now, he's not. Things are just going to speed up. But so far, we've seen that he's fully engaged. And it started when he was a teenager saying, Lord, can I go? Can I go? And I think he just kept saying that all his life. In fact, his favorite word is the word useful. I want to be useful. And you say, well, he's going to burn himself out. Well, like George Whitfield said, better to burn out than rust out, right? Pastor, would you like to close?